Good morning, everyone. I'll call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Elections Conference Committee to order. Ms. Sprite, can you take the role?
Chair Nelson.
I'm here.
Chair Kiffmeyer.
Present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Senator Carlson.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Senator Howe.
Present.
Senator Curran. Senator Lang.
Present.
Representative Mason. Representative Zhang.
Present.
A quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Spreck. And members, this morning, we're going to go over some walkthrough parts of the bill that we haven't had an agreement on and stuff we haven't talked about yet. And I want to start this morning with the Veterans Affairs piece of the bill. And if you go to your side-by-sides, starting on page 18, R18 of the Veterans portion of the bill, this has to do with military affairs, and it has to do with the military code of justice for military affairs. And this was a bill that was brought to us from the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. And we have here Lieutenant Colonel David Blumgren, and I would like him to explain this portion of the bill. Again, this came out of the part from the Veterans Committee that was emerged into us. So Mr. Blumgren, if you want to please state your name for the tape, I mean Colonel, and proceed with your testimony.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I am Lieutenant Colonel David Blumgren, General Counsel to the Minnesota National Guard. Previous to this position that I took about 3 years ago, I spent 11 years on active duty in the Air Force. So first, let me thank you for allowing me to provide testimony this morning in support of this bill. I would say compared to the active duty force, our military justice code or structure is much different, given the fact that many of our members are not on a duty status most days of the month. While we currently have the legal ability on paper to conduct a court-martial, there are gaps that would make it legally impractical to conduct one now. So this bill would fill those gaps and in turn would provide that additional legal tool in a commander's toolbox to ensure good order and discipline in the Minnesota National Guard. One of the gaps this bill fills is the legal authority to receive law enforcement data on Minnesota National Guard members when they are investigated by local law enforcement. In many cases, when local law enforcement investigates a crime and their prosecutor determines that there is not enough evidence to pursue a criminal charge, we still have the ability to pursue administrative action or pursue a court martial. I would say 8 times out of 10, the local jurisdiction gives us a relevant investigation so that we can take action. However, some jurisdictions currently do not. This simply adds time it takes to investigate the wrongdoing, since we then must also do our own investigation, particularly when it comes to allegations of sexual assault. This bill would authorize the Adjutant General to receive, via request from my office, law enforcement data of members of our organization for the sole purpose of taking administrative or criminal action. One of the other gaps this bill would fill are jurisdictional gaps or ambiguity that currently exist on paper. Specifically, it clarifies when members are subject to the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, clarifies which crimes are considered military-specific crimes and therefore give the Minnesota National Guard primary jurisdiction over, and clarifies the maximum punishment for the punitive articles of the code. Similarly, it specifies that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is the investigative arm for the Minnesota National Guard for military-specific crimes. And the fourth gap this bill fills is the appellate process for court-martial. Currently, it's unclear how a defendant or the government would appeal a court-martial proceeding. This change that is proposed would clarify when the appeal period starts to run and clarifies that the appropriate appellate authority is the Minnesota Supreme Court. These changes have been reviewed and concurred by the Minnesota Attorney General's Appellate Division. And then finally, this bill would align the Minnesota Code of Military Justice with updates to the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice with respect to newly added punitive articles. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Members, questions? Senator Kiffmeyer, you have questions for him on this portion.
Are you speaking to a specific article? I mean, there's lots of them.
Well, so
did he cover one, or is he speaking to all?
Colonel, were you speaking to all of the articles 8 through 13, I believe, are encompassed in this? And Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, that was a general overview of all the articles 8 through, I believe, 13.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, there is a lot of language. If we get started, I would prefer to do section by section, but even still, this is judicial. This is judge stuff. This isn't just military things. There is another, there are two other committees in the Senate that has much more specific jurisdiction in regards to this kind of judicial practice. And so,
thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Representative Zhang, I believe this was your bill that you brought forward, and I want to give us a little background on it, Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Chair. So this bill in the House, it had gone through the Veterans Affairs, Military and Veterans Affairs Committee and the Judicial Committee in the House. For the bill, Minnesota Code of Military Justice, the Department of Military Affairs, they base their disciplinary guidance on the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice. And from time to time, it becomes necessary to update the code to maintain alignment with the federal government. Updates to the U.S. Code of Military Justice. And so, and the bill includes some themes that had needed adjustments or clarifications on, for example, appellate changes based on the outcome of some liaison that they did with the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, and included those in the bill as well. I'm not sure if we would want to go our section by section. And maybe Mr. Colonel Blomgren would be willing to do that, or if the chair would like more specific portions to be highlighted.
Colonel Blomgren, do you have the copy of the bill in front of you, or the language? I guess it's section 8. If you want to go through it section by section, explain what each one does, it might be helpful for our members.
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, I do. I appreciate the opportunity to do so. So in section, or article 8 rather, subdivision 1 just clarifies when we have to provide information to the to the local jurisdiction on whether or not a member committed a crime. So typically, majority of crimes that take place by our members, there is a concurrent jurisdiction. So The primary would be the local law enforcement. And then if it's a military-specific crime, one that wouldn't find a similar code in our state criminal code, then we would have primary jurisdiction. So Subdivision 1 just clarifies that we would provide a notice of any crime to the state so that they can investigate. Whereas previously it just said felony, no really real reason why it would only be a felony if there was a misdemeanor offense that we were made aware of during a drill period, for instance, we would notify local law enforcement. That second provision, that's where, as I discussed earlier, we typically, when there is a crime for, let's say sexual assault, for an example, we will notify local law enforcement. They will do their investigation, and then they will let us know whether or not they're going to pursue criminal charges. If it's just a crime that they end up not pursuing criminal charges, we still have the ability to take administrative action, so separate from the guard, or possibly do non-judicial punishment, or in theory could do a court martial. So then we request the law enforcement data. And as I mentioned, we typically don't have a problem, but sometimes we do. And so we get reports that are either redacted, or we have to go to the victim and they have to go get the request to local law enforcement paperwork themselves. So this would require local jurisdictions to hand over investigative reports to us if our adjutant general wanted to review the report so that we can take administrative action against them. I'm happy to answer any specific questions about Article 8.
Any questions, members? Representative Howe, or excuse me, Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I think that is one of the reasons this is probably in the Senate Judiciary jurisdiction, is because now we have our, we are having our National Guard tell our local sheriffs, who is probably the hot, got the most, I would say that they are probably got the highest power in any county, what to do. And I think that's why probably this section belongs in judiciary instead of in this, you know, it's good to talk about it here in veterans and state government, but I think that's where that discussion and that decision really belongs when we're trying to tell county sheriffs exactly how they're going to operate.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Any other questions or comments on this section? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, Mr. Blomquist, is this just about data sharing? Like, so is it when we, I just wanted to clarify, and after Senator Howe's comment, are we just talking about sharing information that the back and forth, or is there more specific directive?
Colonel.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Yes, this is just about data sharing. So we would just be, whenever local law enforcement investigates, closes their investigation, if we want to pursue administrative action, so if we want to kick them out of the guard, we need to have that law enforcement record, because members are entitled typically to a hearing before we kick them out of the military. So we want to provide a due process for all that's involved. And so we need to have that record and able to show the board members what exactly happened. So yes, ma'am, that's specific only to data sharing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr.
Blumgren. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Blumgren.
If there aren't any further questions on this section, Article, if you wanted to talk about Article 9, Colonel.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to. So Article 9 talks about the practice of law in Minnesota. Typically, most of our members are members of the Minnesota National Guard when we do, let's say, an administrative hearing, or if they're advising on an investigation. On occasion, however, we are we require to go outside the state to get, let's say, a defense counsel that's not biased or a part of the command, especially if it's involving a high ranking individual. And so in order to go outside to another state, they're, of course, going to be already authorized to practice military law through the Judge Advocate General of their service. And on the federal side, you just have to be licensed in one state and you can practice military law. Here in the current statute reads that you have to be a member of this state. And so this would change it to allow members that are licensed in another state to be able to provide legal assistance, most likely through defense services, without having to go through the pro hoc vice process of getting admitted to practice. And so this has been, we went through the Office of Lawyer Registration and the Office of Professional Responsibility to ensure that they would have no problems with this change, and they concur that they have no issues with this change.
Members, any questions on this article? Okay, then Colonel, can you go through the next article, which is Article 10, Military Code Jurisdictional Changes.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. So Section 1 clarifies when a member that is under Title 32 status, when they are subject to the Minnesota Code of Military Justice. So it clarifies that as long as they are in Title 32 status, they are subject to the MCMJ. So on occasion, we will go out to, let's say, Fort Hood in Texas and in a Title 32 status and perform training. So this would clarify that even if you're out of the state of Minnesota, you would be subject to the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, as well as, of course, the jurisdiction of wherever they are. So Texas, for instance. It also clarifies between drill periods, one is still under military orders. So if you take a typical drill weekend, it's going to be a Saturday-Sunday drill period. You show up on Saturday morning, you drill all day long, you get released at some point in the day, and then you show back up the next morning. There was there's been some cases not in the state of Minnesota, but a reserve case that determined that said the evening of Saturday night, when they weren't working, there was a crime that happened, and whether or not you're still in a duty status at that point. We'd argue that you are in a duty status in between those periods of drill. So this just clarifies that like on a Saturday night of a drill period, you are still subject to the Minnesota Code of Military Justice. And this mirrors an update to the change in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which applies to the reserves. And so we just lifted the language directly from the Uniform Code of Military Justice to input into the Minnesota Code of Military Justice. So prior to going to Section 2, I'd be happy to take any questions on Section 1.
Any questions on Section 1, members? Doesn't look like it. Anyone jumping up and raising their hand? Colonel, what about the – continue then.
All right, very good. So Section 2 talks about what – crimes are subject to the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, and ultimately it includes that anything that's specifically enumerated. So we have a number of punitive articles that are listed in the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, but also any crime that is in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, we are able to assimilate into we have a general article that's already in existence, which states that just clarifies and that this would also any crime under the UCMJ, you would also be would be a crime under the MCMJ.
Okay, sir. Thank you. Any questions? quiet bunch this morning, it looks like. So if you want to go into Article 11 then, sir, Mr. Colonel.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. So Article 11, Section 1 talks about prescribing rules. So there are different rules for criminal procedure. So in a typical state court, you would follow the state criminal procedure code. We have a military code, military rules of evidence, and military standards for evidence. So the military rules of evidence and the rules for courts martial. And so this just clarifies that if we did a court martial, which we haven't done one since 1928, I believe was the last time we did a court martial. If we did one, we would follow the military rules of evidence and the rules for courts martial. We did talk to the Supreme Court Commissioner on whether or not that would be appropriate, and they said it would. If you have rules that you need to follow, we would just ensure if there was an appeal that you followed the rules that you had on paper. So rather than following the state rules, we would follow the federal military rules.
And I see no hands jumping up for questions. Section 2, Subdivision 3, in that article about 3-year limitation.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this just clarifies that if there is a different statute of limitation in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and there's a lesser in the Minnesota code or in state law, and we would follow the lesser of the two to the advantage, of course, to the defendant.
Thank you. Representative Mason, you have your hand up.
I did, but I think he just answered it. I was just going to ask about whose rules are usually more severe, and he said normally they would go with the lesser one. If I understood this is coming from the last portion as well.
Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, that's correct. We would go with if there are conflicting rules, we would do whatever's to the advantage of the defendant.
Thank you.
Any other questions on this Section 11? If not, members, Colonel Blumgren, if you want to go on to Article 12, then, military sentences.
Yes, thank you. This just clarifies, and we routed this through the Attorney General's Appellate Division on, we've never done an appeal, of course, of a court martial since it's been since 1928, since we did our last court martial. So we went to them to look at our rules to see what needed to be changed. And this one simply adds Section D here. It clarifies when the clock starts to tick for an appeal, and that's going to be on the convening authority, who's typically going to be the adjutant general, issuing the final order at the conclusion of the court martial proceeding. That was when the appellate clock will start to tick. So
Any questions on this article? Article 13 then, sir, and I think that looks like a little bit longer article. Mr. Colonel Blumgren.
Yeah, thank you. So Article 13 is our punitive article updates. So this, there's a number of them in here, and I can go over them in detail, but in general, I would say The Uniform Code of Military Justice updated in 2018 and added a few additional articles that were not previously in the UCMJ. And so we lifted those directly from the UCMJ to apply to the Minnesota Code of Military Justice. Again, we have the general article that allows us to assimilate those crimes anyways, but we would prefer to have those specifically enumerated, especially those that are military specific, so we would have a primary jurisdiction over. And so if you look at Section 1 of Article 13, this adds to the list of those that are purely military-specific offenses. So these are crimes that you wouldn't find a comparable crime under 609 in the state criminal code. And that's why we would need to have the BCA investigate those. So if we have, let's say, you know, an AWOL, you're not going to find an AWOL crime under the state code. A local jurisdiction may or may not take that. I'll give you a specific recent case where we had an allegation of a recruiter having consensual relationship with a recruit. They were of an age where it was not a crime under the state code, but for the military, we take that very seriously. If a recruiter's having consensual relationships with a recruit, we would consider that a crime and we would want to take action against that recruiter. And so in that case, we were able to reach out to a local law enforcement where it happened, and they did us a favor in investigating that, even though it wasn't a crime under their jurisdiction. But if they were not, we wouldn't have no mechanism to request the BCA to do that investigation. So that's what Section 1 Bravo does, is clarifies that if we request the BCA to investigate a military-specific crime, that they would do so. And then it also subdivision A there just kind of adds to the list of those military specific crimes. So happy to answer any questions on Section 1. Otherwise, I can move on to Section 2.
I see no hands up. If you can move on, sir.
All right, very good. The maximum punishment section, we just clarified the maximum punishment. Whereas previously it was a little murky on exactly what the maximum punishment would be for a crime under the MCMJ. And again, we would go back to the lesser of the two if there is a state crime that has a different maximum punishment than what the UCMJ allows. We would do the lesser of the two. And then I believe the maximum would be 10 years.
Thank you, sir. I see no questions again. You want to go on to the next section of that? I think Section 3.
Chair, I'd be happy to. So Section 3 just clarifies, here we have that it is a crime currently in statute to be under the influence of alcohol while you're on duty. We just added as well, if you are under the influence of a controlled substance without a valid medical prescription, that it is also a crime as well. Section 4 talks about search warrant and who has the ability to issue a search warrant, and adds that a peace officer would be allowed to issue, and a military judge could issue a search warrant, and a peace officer would be able to execute that search warrant, because we don't have any an investigative arm within the Minnesota National Guard. We don't have a provost or military police, and we're not considered peace officers under the state law currently.
And then proceed to the next section, if I...
Absolutely. Section 5 just adds 182.39 to the list of articles that are to be explained to members when they enlist. We go through training where they are required to be briefed on the UCMJ and MCMJ and what they are subject to. So that just adds to or clarifies which sections, and just adds one section to that list that needs to be trained to our newly enlisted members. Section 6 is what we briefly talked about before, adding that a member that is a recruiter or otherwise in a position of special trust is prohibited from engaging in specific sexual activity to include consensual sexual activity with a protected member, most likely going to be a recruit or a member that's been recruited, has entered the Guard but has not been to training yet. We call those members trainees or student flight. So they would still be prohibited from engaging in consensual activities with those members. Section 7, and again, these are all lifted from the Uniform Code of Military Justice, specifies that non-consensual distribution of intimate images is a prohibited activity and can be charged for as a crime under the MCMJ. Section 8 talks about fraudulent use of credit cards, particularly when they are using it outside of, if you're provided a government credit card. On occasion, we have members that use those illegally or unauthorized venues. And so that would be, again, a crime under the MCMJ. Similarly, Section 9 talks about the unauthorized use of a government computer. And typically we're talking here about knowingly accessing a government computer if you're not authorized to receive classified information and receiving that information and distributing it to somebody else. Section 10 talks about retaliation. And so if you have a protected communication to a member of Congress or to a state legislator or to the governor's office, and you are then reprised against for making that lawful communication, that can be a crime by whoever makes that reprisal against that member. And that concludes a summary of the changes to the punitive articles of the MCMJ, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
So, members, is there any questions? And Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question for you, Lieutenant Colonel, and that is in regards to sexual assault cases within the National Guard. When there are cases like that, who handles it currently? How is that handled?
Lieutenant Colonel.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you for that question, ma'am. Typically, as you may know, we have sexual assault coordinators that can receive reports of sexual assault. So if it comes to us in that capacity, they have the ability to make a restricted or an unrestricted report. An unrestricted meaning that they are willing to share that information openly, and that an investigation will happen. If it's restricted, then we just provide those services to them, and they can at a later time make that an unrestricted report if they desire to do so. So with an unrestricted report, typically what they will do is the sexual assault coordinator will notify my office along with a number of other individuals. My office will make a notification to local law enforcement unless the victim chooses to do so on his or her own. So we will write a memo to the local law enforcement. They will do their investigation. We meet once a month over those cases, and we will, of course, continue to ask the local law enforcement the status of those investigations. the local law enforcement then will provide their investigation to the county or city attorney, whoever has jurisdiction over that case, and then they will have a primary jurisdiction to do a to charge that member. If they charge that member, we will wait and see what happens with that criminal case. If they're convicted, then we will kick them out of the military. If they choose not to charge that member, we have the ability to do an administrative investigation if we believe that the criminal investigation was not sufficient. There's an Office of Complex Investigations out of the National Guard Bureau in DC. They will come out and do an administrative investigation, provide that report to the Adjutant General, at which point, if it's substantiated, we will initiate administrative separation action, and they will be entitled to a hearing, and then we will present all the evidence to that board member for them to be removed from the Minnesota National Guard.
Chair Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Lieutenant Colonel, having served on judiciary now for my first year ever on judiciary, there's one thing being on that committee after hours and hours of hearings. You realize how greatly involved judicial issues are. They are really important, and especially where there is a lot of crossover between civil, criminal, and then also the military as well. One of the hearings that we had in judiciary had to do with changing how sexual assault cases are handled, especially when it's internal to the National Guard. Are you aware, or were you part of that? I apologize if you testified and I'm just not remembering all of that, but were you part of that Judiciary Committee hearing?
Colonel Blumberg.
Mr. Chair, okay. Senator, yes, ma'am, I'm familiar with that bill. I did not provide testimony, but I have watched some of those hearings. We are in support of that change, which would allow the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to be the primary investigative arm for those cases. As you're probably aware, depending on the jurisdiction, there's a wide variety of how jurisdictions will investigate those crimes, whether it be an inappropriate touching sexual assault or penetrative sexual assault, and it just takes a while for those cases to be investigated at times, and then depending on the report, if it's not sufficient, then we have to go through that process of asking National Guard Bureau to come out, and they are handling, you know, the 54 states and territories, so it's a lengthy process, and so we're doing everything we can to try to shorten that process for all parties involved. And so having one investigative agency, the BCA, be the primary arm to investigate that, we have consistency in those investigations. It would be more timely, and then we wouldn't have a need to go through that administrative process because we would get a quality product out of BCA. So we are in support of that bill, and we do think it would be beneficial for all of our members for speedy justice. And so, yes, ma'am, I'm familiar with that, and happy to answer any specific questions you have on that.
Chair Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was an extensive discussion with staff, with committee members who are very experienced in judiciary and the variety of issues that come to pass. And it was adopted in the judiciary bill, as I understand it. So it is progressing there. Was that language a portion of what we are seeing here in Articles 8 through 13? Is it a part of any of this language that is before us today?
Colonel Blumgren?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the only relevant section compared to that would be part of my delay here, but it would be in Article 13, Section 1, Paragraph B, where it talks about BCA. It would be, it's similar in the sense that the other bill is specific to sexual assaults, and so they would be the primary for all sexual assaults that happen between our members. But there are on occasion other military specific crimes that are not sexual assault, where the local law enforcement would not have, or at least the prosecutor would not have primary jurisdiction. So, for instance, AWOL or a recruiter misconduct. So Section 1 of Article 13 would then allow the Adjutant General to ask the BCA to investigate those cases as well, because that would not be incorporated into the other bill that we were discussing.
Dear Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I have another question, but I see three other hands up, so I will defer my question so other members can have an opportunity.
Thank you, Chair Kiffmeyer. Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you again, Lieutenant Colonel Blomgren. It's been a pleasure working with you. I wanted to talk a bit about Article 9 and one of the important reasons why it was included in there. You know, I'm a licensed attorney here in Minnesota, but I do land use and stuff like that, right? And, you know, why do you think it would be important for military attorneys who are not members of the Minnesota Bar, you know, to be able to come in here and to perform, you know, even though, you know, they're limited duties, legal duties, but being able to, you know, practice here and to handle some of the cases here?
Lieutenant Colonel Blomgren.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zhang, the need for outside attorneys is rare, but it happens on occasion where we only have two defense counsel in the guard, and at times they may be conflicted out from performing duties just because they know the parties. And so we'll have to go to another military attorney in a different state to come in and perform, to advise and potentially be present at a board hearing. Of course, certain attorneys are afraid that advice may constitute the unauthorized practice of law, and so we have to go through the pro hoc vice process to get them admitted in order to do their duties. And so we're just trying to prevent that step that we would take regardless. A member always has the ability to hire a civilian lawyer at their own expense, but we always offer them free military attorneys as well. And so we just want to, in order to prevent having to go through that process, it'd be simpler just to allow those that are certified as competent to do military law through either the Army or the Air Force, TJAG, then they would be certified as competent through their service, and then our state SJA would also certify them as competent to perform those duties. And if we ever did a court martial, again, we would probably want to have a judge from outside the state to come in to perform those duties as well, and so that would apply to that process as well.
Representative Zhang.
Thank you. Just one more follow-up. You know, for the certification, if a service member were to hire outside counsel, would that, you know, Minnesota non-military lawyer have to get the certification too before they can represent?
Colonel Blomgren.
Mr. Chair, I represent the Zhang. No, they would not need to be certified as competent if they are a civilian attorney. I would say a lot of them that specialize in military law are previous JAGs that were currently certified under either the Air Force, the Army, or another branch. But that's not a requirement for them to provide defense services to that member.
Thank you.
Senator Howell, and there's no truth that you knew the person that was part of the 1922 court-martial?
I go back a ways, but not quite that far.
Senator Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Colonel Blumgren. My question goes to really how this provisions and how this data sharing, especially with domestic assault and some of these other things, would, how does that going to intertwine with another bill we're discussing with the Veterans Restorative Act that we're looking at passing? If someone has a domestic assault, and let's say we pass Veterans Restorative Justice, they go through a program, so that charge is dropped, but yet you have the county attorney giving that information to the guard. Is this person, even though he's been identified as maybe having PTSD, has gone through the program successfully, the charges aren't actually, they're dropped. How is the, it, when the guard gets that information, they're still going to drum that person out of the guard? Is that how this is going to intertwine? Or can you explain how that relationship is going to work between the Veterans Restorative Act and this section of military justice and making sure that counties give that information an investigative process? How is that going to affect the soldier?
Colonel Blumgren.
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, thank you for that question. I'm not intimately familiar with the Veterans Restorative Act, so I'm not sure I can speak intelligently on how they would interplay. I would say that our goal, again, for administrative action, we would like to be able to receive, you know, evidence of wrongdoing. Obviously, there's a different standard of proof between, you know, the criminal side and the administrative side. So if we do have bad actors in the Minnesota National Guard, we would we'd like to do what we can to get the evidence necessary to present that to the Adjutant General to determine whether or not to pursue an administrative action or other potentially rehabilitative tools that we have in the commander's toolbox to ensure our members can be rehabilitated. I don't think I'm able to speak quite to your question, since I'm not as familiar with how that Veterans Restorative Act would work. But at the end of the day, I think, yeah, our goal would be able to get what we need to ensure that we have a quality force, but also have evidence in order to be able to rehabilitate members that have that potential.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the answer, Colonel Blumgren. But I do believe that that's something that we need to look at, is how these two pieces of legislation that we're currently looking at and how they're going to intertwine and how they're going to react to one another. Because if we are looking at the Veterans Restorative Justice and bringing an individual through a process that's going to rehabilitate them, but in that same process, we're giving that information up, even though they haven't been connected to the National Guard, who's going to kick them out of the guard, because that's generally speaking what happens, because they can't carry a weapon if they're convicted of a crime. And I'm a little bit concerned how this is all going to interplay if we don't know how this is all going to work. So I think that that's something that maybe Colonel Blumgren can take back to the folks at the National Guard, and we can maybe work on this to maybe clarify exactly how those two, if we pass both bills, how this is going to intertwine and play out to protect these National Guard members, who a number of them suffer from PTSD, and how we bring them back in and protect them from being kicked out of probably the only stable organization that they belong to during this period of time. So that's my comments, and I appreciate the work that's being done. This is, if I can ask, maybe Colonel Blumgren, can you tell me how many other states National Guard have passed similar legislation to this?
Colonel Blumgren.
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, are you talking specifically to the sharing of investigative data?
No, actually,
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. I'm looking at the whole article, this legislation, this whole piece.
Colonel Blumgren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Howe. Yeah, there is a model code of for an MC or state military code. I would say most states have them, and we obviously have one in on paper now. We're just kind of filling the holes or the gaps that make it legally impractical to conduct a court-martial. I would say there is a trend in the last few years of more states doing courts-martial, particularly for sexual assault. And so our neighbors in Wisconsin and Iowa have recently done their first court-martial in many years. There are some states that do this on a regular basis. So I would say that the trend is moving towards doing more courts martial, and I would say every state has something on the books. Whether or not they use it is a different question.
Senator Hall?
Well, I guess we don't have a number then, and I'm a little disappointed not knowing, you know, if the majority of if we're following the majority of the states or if we're on the cutting edge of doing this. I guess that's the question I think needs to be answered.
Thank you, Senator Hall, and members. If I remember right, this is an agency bill that was brought forward from the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. Representative Mason, you have a question.
As a point of clarification, what I'm getting from this is the fact that normally if there's a crime, and even if it's on a military base, it would be the local law jurisdiction that would have authority over that. Is that correct?
Colonel Blumgren.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, yes, that is correct. So majority of crimes that our members commit will be sent to the local law enforcement, and they would have primary jurisdiction to prosecute. If they declined to prosecute, or if it was a military-specific crime, then we would have the ability to take criminal action. But that's going to be a rare instance. So there's only a handful of scenarios that I can envision where we would have primary jurisdiction to prosecute.
Thank you.
Members, any other questions, Representative or Senator Kiffmeyer? Do you have a couple more questions, or?
Well, I would say, in general, all these questions point to the fact that this is not the committee. However, since I have an expert person here, I will ask the question about the Article 12, Section 4. This is a writ of certiorari, and wondering if you could explain a little bit more for the benefit of the committee, because it's striking administrative decisions and using Chapter 14 and other proceedings, findings, sentence of a court-martial as a matter of right. That's only three sentences, but it's a really, really important language there. So if I could get an explanation about that, Lieutenant Colonel.
Lieutenant Colonel Blumgren.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, thank you for that question. So this, again, we met with the Supreme Court Commissioner and the Appellate Division of the Minnesota Court of or Attorney General's Office to determine what the appeal process would be for a court-martial. The determination, because in current statute, it's unclear whether or not it would go to an appeal court or if it would go straight to the Supreme Court. And so the conclusion was that it would be similar to, you know, the tax court. It would go specifically directly to the Supreme Court, and that would be a matter of right by the party to submit a writ of cert to the Supreme Court to hear that appeal. And so this is language that was recommended by the AG's office to include into our bill to ensure that rather than going through the Court of Appeals, that it would go directly to the Supreme Court.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for a matter of information, this language has not gone. It's currently in Civil Law Committee. It's not gone through Judiciary. There are a number of stops with expertise in the Senate in regards to these matters. This language is House only, and it has not gone through the committee process here in the Senate.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. And members, any further questions? If not, Lieutenant Colonel Blumgren, thank you for your time and thank you for the explanation. Like I said, we've got differences of opinion on this from the Senate and the House, and we'll just proceed from here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, next, and that was referenced here, Senator Lang, do you have, I understand you have some language you want us to look at regarding the Restorative Justice Act.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, there was some, I was talking to Senator Kiffmeyer and Representative Feist and Representative Eklund over the last few days, and I believe that is available, the language that we've been talking about. I don't know if Senator Kiffmeyer had it readily available.
Chair Kiffmeyer, I'm looking at it. It was emailed to me this morning, an A43 amendment. It looks like it was similar to the draft that we received earlier. Senator Kiffmeyer?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll have Senator Lang explain this language for you.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Lang, my understanding, this is you worked really hard on this with the interested parties and brought this forward. It's kind of a melding of the language from the Senate, the language from the House. So let Senator Lang, if you want to explain it, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the couple of sections that we changed, number one was that paragraph B in subdivision one that talked about some of the background specifically relating to the veterans or the proposed beneficiary of the program. It was had more to do with what their background was, what their availability of information was to the courts and to the judges that I thought was important to put in the bill. The other section leading up to that was the Rule 25. Now, that was something that I think through conversation with Representative Eklund and Representative Feist, was agreed upon mostly because it was a good idea, I think, as we went forward. They thought, yep, I think we should do something along the lines of that. And the third section, really the only section of difference from the Senate language that was probably a good idea, was the inclusion of the MVDA, and the availability for them to assist veterans in finding both federal assistance when it came to the proposed language and obviously we're going to start at the state level prior to going to that federal level. But those were largely, Mr. Chair, the three portions. As we proceeded forward, most of these sections between the House and the Senate language actually were very complementary to each other. There was a lot of discussion, I think, on pretty small topics. And as far as the committee structure goes, I think that's a good sign that these bills were quite similar when we dug into them. We worked off of both the House and Senate language for several years as this process has gone forward. I think we're in a good position that this proposed amendment, it is actually in a delete all form. And I think we'll clarify the process for the committee members if we've kind of talked about this in depth over the last few committee hearings and week here. So, I appreciate all the work done on both sides of the aisle. I think we have a product that, I spoke about in the first committee hearing that, I think at the end of the day, we're going to have a bill that looks pretty good and hopefully can help some of our vets out with some of the problems they do encounter as they come back to the States. So thanks for all the help. And, I would garner any questions if there is any.
Members, any questions of the of the draft that was emailed out to all of us this morning. Actually, it wasn't the draft. This is an amendment. The draft was dash 11. This is dash is an A43 amendment. And members, any questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one of the things I have come to sense more and more, and especially with our previous conversation with Lieutenant Colonel, in regards to the interaction of the Veterans Restorative Justice Proposal and Military Code of Justice, and the fact that these soldiers, no matter what happens to them on the civil side, are still subject to military code. I think there's going to be some expectations and other points that the current language kind of sets people up to have that. And I'd really like to have Senator Howe address that issue a little bit more.
Senator Howe, I see you have your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. I guess where my concerns are is not so much on the Veterans Restorative Justice piece, or maybe it needs to be in both pieces, but I'm concerned that, just like my question stated, that, you know, a soldier coming back may go through this whole process and go through the Veterans Restorative Justice process, and these charges get dropped because he goes through the program, gets rehabilitated, but that we're gonna get the county attorney to give up that information to the guard, and the guard is gonna boot this guy, male or female. They're gonna boot that soldier. Happens every time. I see very few times you get charged with domestic abuse or domestic assault, I should say, or sexual assault. You're going to come under confines of the Lautenberg Amendment, and they're going to, which means you can't carry a gun, and you're out. And really, that's normally a lot of times the only stable organization that they belong to. And the interaction between these two, I think, is a key thing for me, because I didn't actually think about it until we went through this article by article and with Colonel Blumgren's explanation on how this is going to work, and knowing that we were going to have this discussion on Veterans Restorative Act. You know, and I will tell you, as a commander, as a former commander that had these issues in the past, I'll be the first to admit I would love to turn this over to the local authorities and let them investigate this, because it's one of the most difficult things for a commander to do is go through one of those processes. It's ugly. It tears a unit apart. It's difficult. And I will tell you that being in combat with a unit of 250 and 53 women, it creates an atmosphere that you actually have to manage 24/7, 365, because stuff is always going on. So I look at this, that I support both of these measures. Don't get me wrong. I think both of these are good pieces of legislation. My concern is how they interact and how does it work together. And I'm concerned that once we pass these two pieces, because on their own, they're both excellent. I think they're both good pieces of legislation, but how they interact, I'm concerned some soldiers may bear the brunt by the time we figure out exactly how to fix this and how to make it work. And that's my concern, and I'll leave it at that.
I got a note here that Ben Johnson from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs would like to speak on this. Mr. Johnson? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, Chair Kissmeyer, Chair Anderson, excuse me, Chair Lang, and Senator Howe. So I can't speak to the interplay between the Minnesota Code of Military Justice updates and the VRJA, except to say that a defendant has the option at the beginning of any proceedings to request to be sentenced under the VRJA. And good counsel, defense and prosecutors and courts will make note of the concerns, especially for a currently serving member of the Minnesota National Guard or a reserve component, to let them know that the concerns that Senator Howe has raised certainly could come into play. And I think that that's a decision that needs to be made by the defendant in these cases. So with regards to the VRJA, I did want to just to get on the record once more that MDVA and Governor Walz absolutely support the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. This language that has been introduced as an amendment, it reflects a lot of hard work. And again, really appreciate Senator Lang's hard work to continue to push forward on this. Senator Kiffmeyer, thank you for continuing to be open to this discussion. Chair Nelson, thank you for bringing it up today. I just want to reiterate the concern of including MDVA with a role in this for which we are not currently staffed or to carry out. So for the record, if this passes in its current form, we will do the job as tasked, but we will be back to ask for some funding to do the job. That's what I'd like to get on the record. And I, again, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Senator Kiffmeyer, you had a question.
Yeah, I do for Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, is it currently the role of the Minnesota Veterans and the Veterans Service Officers as well in the counties that if a veteran needs mental health treatment or anything whatsoever like that, that the County Veterans Services Officer and the Minnesota Veterans Administration would assist in that and help that and refer that? Isn't that correct?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair Nelson, Chair Kiffmeyer. In a lot of cases, yes, the primary resource for veterans is the Minnesota County, Minnesota Veterans, excuse me, the County Veterans Service Officers, and we utilize them to align veterans receiving care from the VA and benefits that they've earned with resources for assistance. The agency itself does not provide those resources. We do have the State Soldiers Assistance Program and the CORE program within that, where we utilize a community partner in Lutheran Social Services to find assistance for veterans. But we don't have case managers that interact with the court system. So.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, I don't, it seems as though there's kind of a, it states in here that using county veteran services officers appointed under this, et cetera, whatever is available to the court, that's already in there.
So. Ben Johnson from the Pulse Research, I've got a question for you.
Mr. Chair, do we actually have two Ben Johnsons right now that were?
We have two Ben Johnsons, yes.
All right. How nice.
It's just like in my house, sister guy door knocked one year seven Mike Nelsons, but that's a whole other story. Ben Johnson from House Research. A question I have. Under this, the VRGA bill, if a person gets a stay of adjudication, it's my understanding they would maintain their firearm rights? Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Ben Johnson with House Research. So in terms of firearm rights, the question is going to be whether there's something that triggers a revocation of those rights. In general, when we're talking about criminal activity, it requires a conviction. And if there's no conviction and there's no conviction with a stay of adjudication, then that would not trigger anything related to the firearm rights. There are other ways in which someone can be disqualified from possessing a firearm. And if there were sufficient facts, even outside of a conviction, those additional facts, depending on the specific nature of the charge and the allegations and what could be proven, those additional facts could potentially trigger a revocation. For example, it would be the illegal use of controlled substances, for example, can disqualify someone from possessing a firearm, and that would not necessarily need to be proven as a criminal conviction. I hope that's responsive.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Members, any further questions? Senator Lang, what is your pleasure with this amendment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, if you'd like me to offer it, I sure can.
Senator Lang, why don't you go ahead and make that motion then?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, I'd like to offer the A3 delete all amendment to the Veterans Restorative Justice.
So as I look at the corner of this, it's SCH 1952A43. Is that the same document we're looking at?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I see in the next line there, it says the House on your J3. Okay, I'm looking at a different spot. But anyway, we're on the same document. So Senator Lang moves that this amendment, the A43 amendment, begin to replace the amendment for the R8 Article 7 of the House language, and that we accept it into the conference committee report. Is that what you're asking for, sir?
That's correct. I believe it. On line 1.3, it states on Article 7, page 180, delete Section 11, insert the following, and then it goes on for several pages as all of the language included that we've discussed, and that is the motion, sir.
Any discussion on the motion? If not, take a voice vote on this.
Mr. Chair, I see a hand raised from...
Oh, Senator Howe, your hand went up. Senator Howe.
Yeah, sorry, I snuck it up there. thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be, is there any, and I would ask this, once it's adopted, can we come back and discuss it? Because I'm a little bit leery of, and I guess I'm still have the concern about how the interaction between this and the piece that from the National Guard language is, and whether we can tweak that as far as, of course, the Veterans Restorative Justice doesn't have any sharing of information with the National Guard, but I guess my concern is trying to prohibit that as long as they're in the program. But I don't know if that's quite in there or not. Maybe Senator Lang can talk to that, but that's my concern, is once they're in the program, and maybe we can't do that, maybe that has to be a discussion in this military UCMJ discussion, maybe that's where it has to be. I guess that's a question I'm throwing out there, because I'm a little concerned about the interaction yet.
Senator Howe, it's my understanding, and I guess staff could correct me if I'm wrong, but until we pass this as a final bill out of the conference committee, we could tweak anything in the bill that we've already put in. So if you want to work with Senator Lang and the staff and the advocates to see if there's language, comfort language that you'd want to put in there, that's something you could work on.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I think when you have questions like this, though, I will tell you that once you do, it's much more difficult. I would rather see this language with this kind of a question, that we just hold on it. We have a conference committee again another day, and this is not going to go into final language. I think they've made a huge amount of progress, but I'm a bit uncomfortable with moving forward if we have questions with new information that came to light today with this discussion of 8 through 13. I would rather these be addressed and answered before taking this action.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd just like to make a comment about that and respond to Senator Howe's question, because I think is a valid question. However, I don't think it's the one that we are asking about the amendment that was just offered. I think the question we're asking relates to directly to all the other articles that Lieutenant Colonel Blomgren was talking about. The Veterans Restorative Justice has nothing to do with UCMJ. The Veterans Restorative Justice piece has everything to do with civil law, civil practices that happen within our courts, within our state, within our counties. I do believe it is a valid question. I do believe it should be answered, but I don't believe it should be answered today during this motion, during the hearing we're having right now. I guess I would restate the motion and hope that we could get the A43 amended onto the bill. I don't think that that closes the door on the conversation, however, at that point. And I guess I'd again stand for any questions.
Senator Howe, you had your hand up and you got it back up again. Okay, Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to Senator Lang's point, I think where I would like to see the amendment is more to the UCMJ piece rather than the this Restorative Justice Act. I think that's where the amendment needs to go. But that's my opinion. I think the UCMJ piece needs the amendment, not necessarily the Restorative Justice Act.
Thank you, Senator Hall. Any further discussion? If not, if everybody wants to unmute, I'll restate the motion that's on page 180, delete section 11 of the House language and insert the insert this language from the SCH 1952 A43 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, this is not a matter of choosing which House or Senate. It's an amendment. Could staff please explain the difference between an amendment and then adopting side by side provisions?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, the way I would suggest moving forward is adopting this amendment. What you're doing here is adopting changes to the House language. And then if you then choose to incorporate the House language into the conference committee report, you would have a second vote to adopt this amended language as part of the conference committee report. So there's two steps in the process to have it be in the final document.
Another question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
So, Mr. Gehring, could you also do the same thing with the Senate language or not?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm not sure I'm following your question. So whether you're taking the House language or the Senate language, you would need the final motion to adopt that language into the conference report. I don't know if that answers what you're asking.
Well, it's
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, it sort of does. I think my point is that we're adopting the language, and the House-Senate approach, we're adopting the language. Process may be to one side or the other side, but the main thing is that we're making it simpler by adopting the language instead of going line whatever on the Senate to line whatever in the House, and working that through that way. Is that correct, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, I believe that's accurate.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, the language that's on this of the A43 amendment says it's amending the House language. We could change that to amending the Senate language with this delete all and then adopt the Senate language if you would prefer that.
No, I just wanted to be clear, Mr. Chair, that it really doesn't matter. And I think that's an important consideration and a point that I've made before. This is a joint effort. And so I just want to be sure that that is recognized.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, I agree this was great work by Senator Lang and the proponents from the House. And it was great work on his part to get us to this point so that we have agreement on this. It's great work from the Senate staff that I believe is the one that put this all together and made some, I guess, some technical changes from the earlier draft we had, that grammatical errors that were in it, that they fixed those. So this was great work by the Senate staff and the senator, and I give him full credit. So members, any further discussion? So I guess Senator Lang, you want to restate your motion that to amend the House language of Article 7 on page R8 of the side-by-side report.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I would restate that.
Senator Lang moves to on R8, Article 7 of the House language of the side-by-side to delete the existing language and insert this language. And members, all in favor of that, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion prevails. And now, Senator Lang, do you want to make the motion, or Senator Kiffmeyer, do you want to make the motion to include it in the conference committee report?
Senator Lang can make the motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lang, you want to make the motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would make the motion to include this movement within the conference committee report.
Senator Lang moves that the new Section 11 military veterans piece be included in the conference committee report. Any questions, comments on that section? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. This is now in the conference committee report. Thank you, members, for that. Next, members. There are some sections I want to walk through on the local government side-by-side that there are some Senate-only provisions, and there's a couple of House-only provisions.
There's Senator, no Senate-only provisions, Mr. Chair.
What's that?
There are no Senate-only provisions.
No, not in the
local government that I know of.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I misspoke. The state government portion is what I was talking about.
Oh, state government.
I keep confusing those two in my mind. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Right page in my book here. And Madam Chair, on page 23 of the side-by-side of the state government section, we actually had similar language. This is a similar language having to do with electric vehicles. Madam Chair, if you want to explain to me, maybe we could have the Department of Administration give their explanation. But Madam Chair or Chair Kiffmeyer, the Senate language on the electric vehicles, if you want to explain that to me, explain that to us.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is Senator Howe's language, and he is knowledgeable about it and worked on this. And so I think it'd be good if Senator Howe had that discussion. But I want to emphasize, Mr. Chair, that that we are having today a discussion and information.
That's what I intend. That's what I'm intending for this section, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Howe, if you want to explain this section.
Well, as I have done a lot of electric vehicle charging stuff in the last few, Mr. Chair, but sorry to say, I think this is actually Senator Johnson's language. But it is, I think that what it, from my understanding, what it does and what it's designed to do is not only cover the cost of the electric service fee, but also the depreciation of the electric charging station. So when it comes time to replace that charging station, there's enough funds there to put in a new one. So I think that's the important piece, that if we just pay for the electricity, we're not recovering the depreciation to cover the cost when that charging station is going to have to be replaced. And with, if we include the depreciation for that piece of equipment, it only makes sense that that way the, all the costs are covered and we'll be able to continue to provide that service. Because right now, the initial cost of that came out of the taxpayer funds. And I think it's important that it we'll leave that go, but we should be able to recover the cost as we depreciate that piece of equipment and prepare so the money's there to replace that piece of equipment when it comes time. And that's why that's the major difference between the two pieces from the House and the Senate language.
Thank you, Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We all know that when you have a electricity provided, that there's a lot of infrastructure that goes behind that. And in the price of that electricity is not just the electricity, but all the delivery costs in regards to depreciation and other things. And if we do not include all of that, we're really not fairly providing. And I've had some members say maybe we ought to have a gas provided also, so that those of us are not discriminated against just because we need gas instead of electricity. You know, it kind of gets to be one of these things, why should electric vehicles be in the situation where they get free energy and free charging and others are not provided an equivalent service?
Commissioner Roberts Davis, do you want to weigh in on this? Would this be the Department of Administration or Ms. Roberts Davis, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members, are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. I think that the Department of Administration's position is that we are perfectly fine with charging a fee for electricity. It would be a flat fee. There are not currently any sort of meters on any of the charging stations that are currently on the Capitol complex, and so a flat fee would be something that would be acceptable for us. The equipment that's on the Capitol complex as well has already been paid for, so there's not really any depreciation that's needed at this point in time. The equipment's already been depreciated, and so we would not necessarily see a need to charge for depreciation at this point in time.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm a bit puzzled. The whole point of depreciation is to accrue that. What you're saying here is that somehow you're already depreciating it. What's going to happen in the event of that equipment needing to be replaced? What funds would you use to replace that equipment? Because there will come a time where it will need replacing.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, we will have to replace it at some point in time, and we will, at that point in time, I assume that we will need to depreciate that equipment. You're correct.
Mr.
Chair. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, your answer was at some point in time you're going to have to depreciate that. My question is, where will you get the money to replace it?
Ms. Commissioner.
I assume that there's a fund that's available for appreciation or for this equipment at this point in time. I will get back to you with the specific fund that we use for those purchases, Senator.
Well, to my knowledge,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, to my knowledge, Mr. Chair, I don't know of any fund, any special revenue fund or anything whatsoever. What funds were used when you put in these charging stations? What funds did you use then? Where did that money come from?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, I'd have to research that and get back to you. It's been a number of years since we installed that equipment.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, about how many years has it been there?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, they have been there at least as long as I've been here, so more than 5 years. So it's been at least 5 or 6 years since that equipment's been installed.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, let's be realistic about how the world really works, and that is it costs money to put it in. And yes, it does wear out or technology improves, and then you want to replace it. My question is, how do you give equity in regards to all the vehicles that are on the capital area and that we provide energy currently free of charge, but only to certain vehicles? We don't do that for all. And then there is the projected replacement. Mr. Chair, I'm really not sure how the finances work in regards to this current proposal in the House, because I think it's incomplete and it doesn't address the practical reality of what it takes for equipment.
I don't know if there was a question there, Senator Commissioner.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I don't know how to raise my hand in Zoom. it's my understanding that the parking fund was used for the initial purchase of the charging stations, which means that people who are actually paying to park are using the charging stations. So there has been some payment toward use of those charging stations. There was some outlay of funds in order to get access to those charging stations.
So, Mr. Chair,
Kiffmeyer.
Isn't this interesting? Probably 95% of the vehicles are gas-powered vehicles, but their parking fees are being used to subsidize only electric vehicles. What an interesting situation. While we rail against, not us, but others do, in regards to that, but then they're perfectly happy to take that money and use it to subsidize the energy of electric vehicles. We pay for it, but we don't see that. Maybe it should be that electrical vehicles parking fees should be included in this for this special service to compensate for that. But right now here we have gas-powered vehicles largely subsidizing electric vehicles' energy. Once again, this happens numerous times where we see this happening, and in this particular issue, did you have statutory authority to install electric vehicle charging stations, Commissioner?
Commissioner, and I think you said they were there before you were Commissioner.
Well, the Office of Admin Administration.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, that is correct. They were there prior to me being commissioner. I would have to research that, but I would assume that we would have had statutory authority. I will research that, though, and let you know.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
And I would also just add that we're talking about 1 to 2, in general, 1 to 2 charging stations per garage.
Mr. Chair, I don't care how many charging stations are in MAPAC. Sorry, Mr. Chair. That in regard to this, I think it makes my point exactly. All of the other gas-powered vehicles are subsidizing a few electric vehicles, and that's just very unfair to hear about that, but I see another hand is up, Mr. Chair. I'll defer for now.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the thing is I agree, some of those, I believe a couple of those charging stations have been there for quite some time, but they just doubled the amount of charging stations in that parking ramp in the Senate parking just recently. We added charging stations. And the point of depreciation, if you've been in business and you buy a piece of equipment, you depreciate that, you put that money away to replace that piece of equipment. If you're not going to charge for depreciation, you will not have the cash or the finances to replace that piece of charging station when it comes time to replace it. That's the whole purpose of charging the depreciation, so you have those funds. And I stated this a couple of years ago in committee when Senator Dibble brought up the fact that everyone paying there to park pays for that electricity. And I will say at that time, I said it at that time and I'll say it again, I don't appreciate me funding their fuel, because that's what it is. I fund their fuel to drive that vehicle. And I do believe that it's only fair and equitable that they pay for their own fuel. And that's what this is about. And that's why we should charge a depreciation to ensure that we have the funds to replace them and we're not taking it out of the funds that the rest of the folks that park there are paying. And that's where they should pay for their own fuel and their own charging station when it comes time. I'm not going backwards to have to recoup what has already been spent. We're just talking about the depreciation to replace them when the time comes. And I think it's only fair and just that that's the way it is done. Thank you.
Senator Curran.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from the administration, Commissioner Robert Davis. Has the administration continued to move and install these charging stations all throughout state property? And if so, when will you migrate to a device that can actually charge the appropriate user the appropriate rate for their consumption? I'm just not comfortable with you picking an arbitrary fixed rate fee based on those, you know, the habits. I'm pretty sure everybody who drives one of those cute little cars is pretty smart to figure out they'd be a lot cheaper on a fixed rate to fully charge at work than at home on your own, because we can all determine how to efficiently refuel our transportation. So I'm not comfortable with, I think you should charge, but I'm not comfortable with you just picking some random flat fee. I think it should be, you should be adopting technologies, and certainly everything from this day forward should adopt a technology that makes sure that they are charged just for the appropriate electrical use that they have and the appropriate upkeep and maintenance for the equipment. So I'd be curious to see what the administration position is now that you are in charge of the agency. So thank you.
Commissioner?
Chair Nelson, thank you, Senator. We have achieved funding for additional charging stations throughout the area. Those will not start to be installed until later this year, meaning fall, I believe. There will be fees associated with charging at those stations. The fees are not arbitrary. They are based on past use, and there are mechanisms that will be able to be programmed for charging based on use with those particular charging stations.
Thank you.
Senator Curran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the response.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I think we're discussing something that is maybe just an ideology difference. But I do want to say that in business, you don't use depreciation as the term here. You use accumulation. You accumulate an amount for depreciation is something that you use to expense the costs during the time that this has a useful life. And I would say that when we get to the point, which we don't know right now how long these devices are going to last, they could last for years and years and years. But I do support the idea of having the user pay for the power that they're that they are charging their cars with. And I think, and I've done a little bit of research, and there are companies that are working on this. And, you know, it's going to be kind of like your parking meter, where you you actually go to a place and plug in your number, and then you pay per hour that you're at that parking meter. You're going to pay per hour that you're also charging your vehicle. And, you know, the fact is that I don't think people are waiting until they need a total charge to come into the Senate building and then charge their car. I think that they probably plug in just to top it off, just like you do when you make sure that you top off your gasoline tank. So I guess I can't get all wound up about this, but you know, if we really want to talk about who's paying for what, then maybe as soon as we get to a carbon tax, this is going to level out, because these vehicles are not making the kind of. I don't have an electric car. I have a car that makes a lot of carbon, matter of fact. And I'm going to be probably replacing it with an electric car. I might have to buy a new car. So I think we're going to get there. But I just can't find the reason to argue about this as though we're arguing for what we're going to have for breakfast next week. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Carlson. I'm not arguing about my breakfast. I intend to have a lot of bacon next week, but I will say that to your point on gasoline-powered vehicles, they are already paying a fee to do a lot of the maintenance and things around the state in the gas tax that they pay at the pump. But I agree, and it's always a red letter day when I agree with the Senate completely that. This has to be charged. And for the commissioner not to know what funds have been used, as we're going to be talking about this in committee today, I find a little awkward. But I know for a fact a lot of folks who drive electric vehicles, I heard it on a golf course last year, that they are always thrilled that they work somewhere that is so obtuse that they don't charge them a fee for charging, because they're topping off their tank, and they do manage their battery life around when are they going to be at work to soak up all the free electricity. So I think that it's important that we're having this conversation. I think it's even more important that we do something to make sure that those people who are purchasing these vehicles and are working at the Capitol are being charged to top off their tank, metaphorically, because, you know, the state and its largesse does need a couple of bumpers put up, and this is one of them. This is something that's preposterous, to not charge people for the utilization of filling up their tank. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Chair. Yes. So, Commissioner, would you please explain, you're mentioning they're going to be putting additional electric vehicle charging stations on the Capitol grounds. So where's that money coming from to do that?
There was an appropriation, Chair Nelson, that we received, and it was appropriation bond funds that the Department of Administration achieved for additional charging stations.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you. So, Commissioner, are you also planning then, so you treat everybody who's paying those parking fees to install also some relevant gas stations for the other cars who are paying parking fees so they can get their energy?
Commissioner Davis.
Chair Nelson, I'm not sure I understood the question. It sounded like you asked about gas stations, and I don't. There are no plans to install gas stations. I thought that was the question.
It's not about a gas. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not about a gas station. It's about providing gas. Just as now the electric vehicles can pull in and charge up their vehicles, I would think we'd be able to pull in and fill up our tanks with some gas. That's all.
That Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, that is not contemplated, no.
Mr. Chair, as I thought.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, as I thought. So just paying for the energy and not paying for any of the infrastructure is not acceptable. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mason, and then we're going to move on. I think we've discussed this thoroughly. Okay. We've got some stuff to talk about. Representative Mason.
Just a couple of comments. One is right now, because we're trying to deal with climate issues, certainly people are being encouraged to get electric cars. We're trying to get rid of the fossil fuels. Right now, to me, it seems to me we are more in a pilot program type mode. And I'm assuming that when most of us that are parking have electric cars, accommodations will be made at this point. So I guess I think we're a little bit premature on where you're trying to do the try to make it more difficult for people to move ahead. Thank you.
It was more of a comment than a question. Senator Curran, I see you got your hand up. Senator Curran, I got your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Mason highlighted one of the other, probably the most significant component in the cost of implementing these. These are going to be in remote parking locations as well. And you know, the consumption or the power demand for these is pretty high. It's not the standard plug-in outlet of running a fan. And so I would like to know, what's the average cost of the infrastructure that we have to install in a building that may have additional capacity? It may still be available. But what's that average cost of the infrastructure in addition to the charging machine itself? Because if we're trenching electric lines across the city block or even further to install throughout the Capitol grounds and in the public ground, we're talking about thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so I would like to see what the total cost is. And I think we should be obligated, you should be obligated to inform the legislature. I think we talked about where the funds are, but that's probably a far greater cost than anything we've had a conversation about to this point, because it's massive. And so I'd like to know what those are. And then I think Senator Kiffmeyer, we've talked about the funding of it. I'm assuming a portion of this is part of the Volkswagen settlement as well. Is some of that money going to these charging stations? But I think the agencies owe us and understand the responsibility you have to the citizens and the cavalier attitude that we'll just put them in and at the cost of state government to other citizens for somebody's choice is completely unfair. But I'd like to know, what's that average cost? Because it's going to be pretty significant, and I think we should be aware of that in the legislature. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer, you want to wrap up, and then we can move on to another provision that's in the bill, that a Senate provision I wanted to talk about.
Yes, well, Representative Mason brought up a subject that I think really needed to be addressed, and that is, let's talk about the fact that while you think it's real clean and carbon-free, when you plug your car into a charging station. But the energy, where does that come from? It comes from natural gas, in some cases, even coal-fired plants, of which, by the way, they're getting much cleaner, and so are natural gas. Probably the one true carbon-free is nuclear power. That is the one that is really actually carbon-free and does it. But to think that somehow this electricity, just because you plug your car and you don't see the carbon, that is not true. Electricity is made, and in the process of being created and made, it is using carbon and is not carbon-free. So you can't just say plugging it into a station and it all looks real clean, and you don't reckon with the fact of where how this electricity is made. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. And members, the next section I want to discuss was on page R42 and 44. And again, this is a Senate provision that we didn't have in the House. And I just want to find out some more about it. It has to do with the Racing Commission. And I believe my reading through this, and I don't know if Senator Kiffmeyer, if you can explain this, or if there's somebody whose bill this was, but it has to do with the Racing Commission and approved racing days. And I think a lot of this has to do with what went on during the pandemic. And so Senator Kiffmeyer, well, maybe you can give the committee a brief description of this.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the stakeholders, not just the Racing Commission, but the Racing Commission is the one that worked it through with the other stakeholders. The Horse Association, Horsemen's Association, Women's Association, the stakeholders worked very hard and came forward with an agreement of this language. And Mr. Chair, could you remind me which page that is again? I've looked for it, but I'm not finding it right now.
Chair Kiffmeyer, it starts on page R42, and then it runs through, I believe, R44. There's it'd be Senate Section 81, 82, mm-hmm. 83, 84, 85, through up to 86 and 87, I think, are all dealing with the Racing Commission.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just haven't gotten that far yet. I was only on 32. Okay. So, yes, Mr. Chair. So if you see these, they are stakeholder agreements between all the stakeholders that are involved here brought forward by the Racing Commission. And in particular, has to do with providing advance deposit wagering transferred with prior approval by the commission. That's important to realize. And then also the payments to the state on line 69.9. Then some costs included incurred by the commission as well with regulating horse racing and paramutual. And yes, part of this is response that we actually did this, I think it was last year, we adjusted language at the request of the Racing Commission and stakeholders. And this is just continuing from that since the restrictions have continued far beyond what they thought it would have been. And so in the summertime, this is their season. This is when they are active, and this is really critical to them in surviving this. On 69.22, it says the commission may be reimbursed for these expenses as well, and fees that can be used to recover the costs of medical testing as well. And then it goes on to limitation, and it just goes into that makes conducting 50 days of live racing untenable for either public or equine health. And that's probably the most operative kind of thing, because they currently have if you see on line 69.32, a requirement for at least 50 days of live racing. Well, as you know, during the governor's orders and this particular time, that is greatly restricted. And so this enables them that if they cannot do 50 days of live racing, then they are able to do it for a shorter period, as it states on 70.5. And again, this must be approved in writing by the horse persons organization, representing the majority of horse persons, as well as the majority affecting the facilities. And so this is very much more technical, and that's why it was important for all the stakeholders to be involved and come through this process and this agreement.
And Madam Chair, my understanding is that this doesn't have any general fund effect on our bill. They're covered by the Racing Commission and the fees they charge.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Members, any questions on this section? House members or senators? I don't believe we heard this in the House, in our committee, so that's why I asked. I wanted to ask about it.
Seems and Mr. Chair, innocuous. Yeah, more details can be explained by the Racing Commission itself. They obviously are the most knowledgeable about it.
And I don't think I see anybody here from the Racing Commission. If there is, speak up. If not, any questions, members? If not, that's one issue there. Now, the next one I want to talk about is section we have, and this is House language. I got to remember what page that is on. Having to do with the tribal intergovernmental relations between the tribal governments of the state of Minnesota. And I know this is House only language. And my explanation of this is my understanding is currently going back to, been told back to Governor Ventura, they've had executive orders signed by the governors to do this. This language is basically comes right out of the executive order. Was came forward to put this in statute so that we will continue doing this. And I guess that's a section that we have in the bill here. And I don't know if Mr. Gehring could explain it better than that, or maybe one of the other nonpartisan staff. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, the language you're looking for is on the side-by-side. It's on page R13. It's House Section 17. And I think you summed it up pretty well. So this is effectively a codification of the executive orders that have been in place for a number of years that require it recognizes the tribal status and relationship between the state and the tribes in Minnesota as sort of co-equal units of government and requires a meaningful and timely consultation process between agencies and affected tribes for certain types of work. And there's a number of details in the language about how that consultation would work and what the process is.
So members, any questions of that? Senators, any questions? I know it wasn't on your language, wasn't in your bill. Do you have any questions on this? Again, it's my understanding this goes back. Governor Ventura had it. Signed had an executive order like this, Governor Pawlenty, Dayton, and now Governor Walz.
Well, Mr. Chair, if it's been done this way, I don't see the need to have it.
Senator Kiffmeyer, thank you. Any other questions? The position we brought in the Senate from the House is to put it in statute so that way it's there. These are the 11 tribes, I believe it's 11 tribes if I remember right, that are in our state that have relations with the state, that this would be helpful for them, that we don't have to worry about every governor, maybe some decides not to do it and could create issues in the future. But members, any questions or statements or concerns? If not, the next section I have here that I wanted to discuss is on page R10. And again, this is House only language that we had. And it deals with the census data. It's on R10, section 12 of the House language. And it's dealing with the state demographer. It's because of the issues that we have with the census this year, and that technically if we are close to being in violation or are in violation of the statute because we haven't gotten the information yet from the federal government. And what this is doing is basically in years of the decennial census that this information, instead of having it done by June 1st of each year or doing time certain, it would be 6 weeks after we received the data from the U.S. Census Bureau of those years. And that's essentially what it's doing. And I guess I'll ask Mr. Gehring if that's his understanding of it also. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, yeah, that's correct. So this is language that came from the Department of Administration reflecting the delay in the census data. There's actually a corresponding section that goes with it a little bit later. I'm trying to find it quick that relates to the data that is submitted to the Met Council. But you see the substance of it on page R10, House Section 12.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chair, the person or the entity, I should say, that's in default here is the Federal Census Bureau. This was not necessary. This data was ready when the previous president left office. And so Minnesota is not in violation. It is the federal government that is in violation of not providing this data to the states. So I don't think our state demographer has any reason to be concerned, because if you don't get the federal census data, you don't need to worry about the fact that it's going to be critically important that when the data does come, that we are ready for it. And I think that with this amount of time, I would certainly expect that our state demographer and our folks here are ready to take quick action when this data does come from the Federal Census Bureau. And that's the issue that I'm concerned about, is are they ready? Because it's going to be a short time, and a short time frame is going to be really crucial for them to be prepared and ready to act on the data as soon as it comes.
Representative Greenman, question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nelson. And I think to that point, I'm wondering, I don't know if we have the state demographer on, but and I know they do really great work. I was just sort of interested in how, given that I think this is part of what they said they needed to do their best work, how these legal changes would help them be ready and help them now as we face this crunch. I don't know if the commissioner or if we can get the state demographer on, but it feels like the agency is telling us what they need, and I'd love to hear from them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Davis, can you enlighten us on this?
Chair Nelson, members, I think that the concern here is exactly what's already been stated, is that we would be technically in violation of law. And what we're just trying to do is clean it up and make sure that we have ample time to provide back the information that we need to provide back. So saying that we have a firm 6 weeks after the information is provided to us is just a very clean way to write it into the law that we're compliant.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was helpful.
Any further discussion? Thank you. Another one, Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, that I wanted to ask about is on page R36. And it's a report that you have there, and I guess it's just report of the state archaeologist. And if you could explain that to the House members, what that's about. HR 36, section 66.
Well, the State Historic Preservation Office is within the Department of Administration. And so if you're going to consult with other people in regards to archaeology, the State Historic Preservation Office should logically be included in that.
Okay. Like I said, I was looking through this and to see things that we haven't discussed yet. Any questions from any members on that? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because I noticed it wasn't in our language. I'm just wondering, is this something the Department of Administration or that SHPO asked for to be included? Or just sort of wondering the origins.
Commissioner Davis.
Mr. Chair, members, we did not ask for this language. We're neutral on this language, but we did not request it.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, the question then is, do you oppose this section?
Commissioner Davis.
Mr. Chair, members, we're neutral.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess that's what I have on my list here. Senator Kiffmeyer, is there anything that you wanted to look at and talk about, or other than what we've brought up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are some things, but I'm not ready for them today. I would have that possibly ready for tomorrow.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Any other members have anything, any items they would like to bring up that we haven't discussed yet that are in either bill? If not, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very minor provision that you graciously allowed me to put in the bill as an amendment on the floor regarding the ability for charitable organizations like VFWs, Legions, other groups like Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, and such to allow a temporary payment form of debit card to take raffle sales. It's supported by a lot of VFWs, Legions, and those other organizations. I know it didn't make it into the Senate bill and was just hoping that we might have a very brief discussion and see if we can just move that forward.
Do you know what page that is, page it off the top of your head?
Mr. Chair, I don't.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Gehring.
It's on page R53. It's House Section 56. House Section 55, but page
R53. House Section 55. Senator Kiffmeyer, if you had a chance to look at that.
Mr. Chair, could you explain this a little bit more than what Representative Nash did since it was heard in your committee?
Senator Kiffmeyer, as Representative Nash said, that some of these groups that would normally hold raffles and they'd be selling raffle tickets on the premises, I think you probably would even include groups like the local fire departments that may sell raffle tickets. The members, because they weren't able to meet in person, they weren't able to sell those raffle tickets, and some of those organizations, that's how they raised the money to fund themselves. This is what was explained to me by Representative Nash, and this would be a one-year, allow them through next July 1 to be able to do this with a credit card or a debit card over the phone as opposed to in person. And
And Mr. Chair, it would be a debit card, not a credit card. And if you would allow me,
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And House Nonpartisan Research did vet this very closely to point out that this did not violate any federal Wire Act laws, that this is something that, not knowing at the time where things were going to be going with the pandemic and still not knowing where they were going now, even though the mask mandate has been lifted, wanted to make sure that these groups continue to be able to do the things that they do for our communities. I was very grateful that you put this in the bill after discussing it with you and Representative Hewitt and others, that this is just a very good and benign provision to put into the bill.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I... is the ease of which a debit card, with a credit card, you have time to contest a charge. A debit card is an immediate deduction, but I know that you can still, on a bank statement, I helped a grandson whose debit card was compromised, and all of a sudden he had charges against his card that he had not authorized. So having it be a debit card, is there any, and maybe this is part of it, when they confirm the card is a debit card, and they check the number, do they also make sure that the person shows an ID that is connected with that debit card?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, so the process would be, Madam Chair, would be that if I were to be buying a raffle ticket, I would be on the phone. They would enter the card, and then I would have to enter the PIN. So that two-factor authentication would be available. So it would be providing a level of security using that PIN number, that token that the person knows. so that they are able to not only have something that you possess, but also something that you know in order to create the level of security. And that's why the credit card was not utilized. It was done to provide a two-factor authentication.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chair, with that explanation, I would accept Section 55 from the House.
Okay, well, we're discussing these today, and we can discuss these. And
I'm just letting you know.
Yep. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When the advocates brought this to me and described it, they talked about this, that these organizations that want to sell these tickets by debit card were, you know, they were harmed because of the pandemic and not being able to meet together, that sort of thing. And they represented it that this would be used for their own members. For instance, Ducks Unlimited would call Ducks Unlimited members and so on. You know, if there were other agencies that would, or groups that would use this, that they would be calling their own members. I don't know if this is known, but from what I understand now, this would also cover cold calls where there would be fundraising that would call lists of people that are not their own members. And I guess I'm not sure who to ask, but maybe Mr. Chair, the Representative Nash could answer that, whether these cover cold calls as well, people that are not known by the caller.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, as it was relayed to me, this would be something that a person calls in to make that purchase, not a proactive cold call outbound. So someone says, Senator Carlson, we'd like to see if you'd like to buy a raffle ticket to the Ducks Unlimited banquet or to the Pheasants Forever, banquet. And then you would be reacting on your own, not as a result of an outbound cold call.
Mr.
Chair, is there some way we can confirm that's what it is that these are incoming calls from the members? I mean, I want to make sure that we don't, I don't answer my landline anymore because the calls that come in are just incredibly intrusive, and also everybody wants money. So I really am very concerned about adding another method or mechanism for having cold calls for money. And if there's some way that this either limits it or is an agreement with the organization, and I'm not exactly sure how the language is and how that's interpreted, but I would appreciate really knowing that.
And Senator Carlson, we can try and find out that information before we bring this up for a vote.
Mr. Chair, I can answer that question.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson. So if the language on it's how Section 55 lines 59.22 and 59.23 requires that it be a telephone communication initiated by a person seeking to purchase a raffle ticket. So that's the inbound call language that Representative Nash was referencing.
Senator Carlson, Senator Kiffmeyer, you had a question.
Thank you. So I have a question for Representative Nash. You've mentioned that now with the mask mandate being lifted, that has changed the circumstances. I have several members that are communicating with me that strongly object to some of this area and have concerns about it. And so the question part of it is, with the mask mandate being lifted, would you address that a little bit more from your previous comments?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. Well, one, not knowing until the governor's executive powers are removed, which will be a great day, whether or not we're going to head back into something, I think, again, that means that we could pass this and make it available and hope that we never have to use it. But if the governor decides to implement certain things again, it would be prudent and benign, given that this has a sunset and that they're not going to be telemarketed, as I had said previously, and Mr. Gehring from House Research confirmed, that this is not something that is going to be onerous. This is permissive. This is not something that is going to, you know, everybody in the city of Waconia is going to be smiled and dialed by the Waconia Fire Department. This is something that you choose to participate in. This is something that, you know, if an organization themselves doesn't want to get everybody together or doesn't have the runway to get an event planned in a short amount of time, but would still like to do their raffles, that this would enable them to do that.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think in light of that, we need to do a little bit more research on this. I think some questions are being brought up to me that I need to get some answers first, but I appreciate Representative Nash responses, very helpful, but I think we just need a little bit more time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Kiffmeyer. And members, that's all I've got. I guess before we adjourn, Senator Kiffmeyer, do you have plans? Can we know what our plans are for tomorrow?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping to have more of a discussion on the SHPO provisions, the State Historic Preservation Office provisions. That's the area that I think there are a number of sections in regards to that. So I'd like think we just need to get a little bit more information about that. There may be some others like for you today that would be maybe smaller issues, but that would be the main area.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Well, members, any other questions or concerns? If not, thank you all for your work this morning and the good questions. And with that, members, we are adjourned for today.